Yeah.
This controller like move up and down the elevator. So
Oh my gosh, dude. They talk about like impact, right? Like, we talk about
exactly.
like,
So
oh yeah, your database is gonna see like a, performance deficit, and they're like, your elevator will literally drop. Like, So we've all been on those pen tests before, right? Where we're just banging our head into the external attack surface of a company for what feels like an eternity. And then when you finally get inside the network, it's like open freaking season. There are accessible shares everywhere. CVs are popping left and right. There's seemingly no controls at all on what ports can or cannot be accessed. Too many companies are neglecting their internal network security, and that's why ThreatLocker came up with this product, Network Control, which makes it super easy to control what kind of ports are exposed on a given host, whether that be a user machine or a server. The thing I like the most about Network Control is that it understands far more than just the IP layer. You can allocate specific controls to keywords or tags, and then use those to manage access from different machines, regardless of whether they change IPs or not. So if you're looking to shore up your internal network, make sure you check out Network Control by ThreatLocker. All right, let's go back to the show. All right, dude.
Yeah, let's go.
I am looking at this doc and we have a banger today, dude. There's so much good content in here. So I'm super excited. Sharon, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm really happy to be here today.
Dude, and right before the episode, we were just, talking about it, our hacker swag in the background, for those of you following on YouTube, and we got the Pwn to Own trophy right behind you there.
We have it right here.
Oh my gosh, dude. All right, that's on my list, dude. That is on my list. I gotta get one of those. I got a HackerOne MVH, I got a Google MVH, and then I gotta get one of those Pwn to Own trophies, man.
Yeah, you'll get it. I'm sure you'll get it one day.
Well, dude, we'll definitely talk a little bit more about that, but I just So let me give a little context here, okay? So one of the problems that I see with the bug bounty world right now is that there's a decent amount of segmentation, right? There's like the HackerOne bug crowd squad, and then there's like the Pwn to Own squad, and then there's a bunch of other little sub communities, like Google has their own researcher base, Meta has their own researcher base, that sort of thing. And as I've been, sort of living in the HackerOne bug crowd integrity space for a long time, I started getting a little bit interested in some of these other bug bounty niches like Pwn to Own and stuff, and so I we did an episode with Sin Synology, which was amazing. And then at this live hacking event, this HackerOne live hacking event, I see this random guy that just comes onto the stage, does this amazing show and tell, extremely technically dense, amazing performance. And that is you, sir. And that started the deep dive. That started the research. And then I say, who's the Sharon guy? And then I start looking into it. I start finding all of your write-ups and stuff. And holy crap, dude. Like, what a portfolio. So I guess, man, where do we even start? I guess, can you give me a little bit of background for how you got to this point as a researcher, where you're competing in HackerOne live hacking events and taking away awards, competing in Pwn to Own, and then somehow solving phishing in Israel on the weekends? Like, give me a little
Well, I'm
context.
embarrassed. I'm blushed. Thanks, man. I started pretty early. I mean, today there are a lot of 8-year-old kids that are building iOS applications, but my journey started actually with the first iPhone. So I got this present. My mom didn't want my dad to buy the first iPhone, because she told him it's too luxury. But he decided to buy me the first iPhone. I really remember this. It was the 2010, 2011, I think, or maybe earlier. And I got the iPhone, and I started to develop iOS applications for the first iPhone. I remember the day that the App Store was born, and I submitted my app. I was very anxious, and they got submitted. So This is I was around at the age of 16, but and I submitted the first app and I started to do some money out of iOS applications in the very early days. Like the first app that I had was a reminder application, was completely crap. But the thing is, I was intrigued to develop. I was incentivized and I got motivated to learn computers. So I owe this to my father, to be honest.
That's amazing. You know, so when you get started early like that, I think it's a different world. You know, it's something that becomes a part of you really, really core on early in the process. But yeah, so you start in the iOS development, I guess the iOS world, and then and then where do we go from there? How do we turn into the hacker that we are today?
So I started as iOS developer. I had Hackintosh, so I did not have enough money to buy a Mac computer. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of Google to understand how do I create a Hackintosh VM. It was a thing back then. So because I had no money, I had to do some hacking in order to create like a virtual Mac OS X, nice. Which is Hackintosh. And this is how I started to develop applications, learn some computer stuff. I needed to gain some knowledge in order to do certain stuff. So for example, I had to use some kind of a database. I did not know what a database is. I just knew I need to store some information.
So
I think my hacking knowledge was built layer by layer by myself needed to do something.
Right.
So I started as iOS developer, and then I started to do some website development, and then I did some kind of hacking, I would say. You know, I tried to do web hacking and tried to understand what is JavaScript and client side and their server side.
Okay, so you did start in the web world a little bit, right?
Just a little bit.
All right, because that's one of the things that I'm like, you know, as primarily a web guy, I look at a lot of these pwn-to-own stuff, and I'm like, wow, this is like so much time and effort put into these exploits and this research, right? And so it's cool to see, you know, especially if somebody started in the web arena and then shifted into that more, you know, low-level exploitation, you know, afterwards, because that shows, you know, the continued commitment to depth. I think one of the things that is a common thread that I've seen across a lot of hackers, though, is that sort of like not really hacking, but sort of hacky past, right? Where it's like, oh, you know, I had to build this whole like, you know, ecosystem to do the thing that I wanted to do. And it wasn't really like hacking, but it was hacky, you know? I think that's pretty consistent across the board. And I think it sets you up for the right kind of mentality going into hacking long term.
Yeah, I agree. I think that hackers, I would say, you know, folks that did not start from an educational background, you know, from university or something like that, they started from a place where they wanted to build something and then acquired the knowledge to do that layer by layer. This is the hacker mentality that you're talking about.
Totally agree. Yep.
So yeah, I did some iOS applications and then a little bit web, especially because I needed to build the backend for my applications. Mm. So that's where I started with mostly PHP.
Classic.
Yeah. And then a little bit of Python. But then I started I started to be exposed to the CTF world. And then I started to do CTFs. And this is where I really started my actual gaining knowledge into binary exploitation and actually hacking competitions. Mm. So I did a lot of CTFs. I'm still doing when I have time and when my wife is not mad at me.
I'm like, what do you mean when you have time? You're like doing all this IoT research. You're doing web hacking stuff. You're doing, oh my gosh, dude, that's crazy. Do you remember how you first got that exposure to CTFs though? I'm wondering if that was like through university or something you just found online or what?
I think that one of my friends told me, hey, there is this Google hacking competition. I think it was Google. I'm not sure. And I was, wow, it sounds cool. I really wanted to be a hacker. And then I signed up for the CTF and I did not understand nothing. I mean, I didn't understand what is a binary exploitation, what is Stack Buffer Overflow. I mean,
right.
I knew nothing. And this is a great starting point for someone who is very curious to see a lot of different terminology and cool stuff that they want to do, but they don't understand or they do not know it. And this is a great starting point to start learning about this stuff.
Absolutely.
So that's my kind of my journey. I saw something that I really wanted to get experience with and understand, and I knew nothing. And so I started a bit by bit, you know, all the starting CTFs and little competitions. This is a great place to start.
Well, you learn the things to Google too, right? Like you're like, oh, I didn't even know what binary exploitation was or like what a Stack Overflow was or whatever, right? And so, you know, then you come out of that CTF and you're like, okay, now I know I got to go home and I got to figure that out, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that's how we grow. No, that's a great story. And I think it's clear, you know, the kind of academic motivation or intellectual motivation that a lot of the hackers bring to the table, where it's like, oh, I don't understand this thing. I'm not going to give up on that. I'm going to just keep on, you know, pounding it until I freaking understand that, because I am going to become a hacker. Exactly. You know, yeah, I love that, man. Okay, so fast forwarding a little bit, we've got, you know, we've got a black badge. We're SANS, you know, Institute Researcher of the Year. We're winning live hacking events left and right. Yeah, dude, it's amazing. So tell me a little bit about the day job now and how you participate in bug bounties currently.
Yeah, so fast forward today, I'm managing the research department in a company called Clarity. Mm-hmm. Clarity as a company develops IDS for SCADA networks. Mm. This means we have a really good understanding and kind of esoteric protocols that are very popular among SCADA networks. So I started in Clarity as a protocol analyst, you can call it, I guess.
Dude, what a freaking cool name, protocol analyst. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I mean, my journey in this company started where we needed to add more support in more protocols that are not open, right? So they're closed systems, and somehow we needed to add support into our product to understand how these protocols work.
You know, there was like some product, I saw this from one of your talks, but there's like some product, right, where or some protocol where, you know, it's connecting to all of these different SCADA devices, right? And it's you know, pulling all this data in together. And I think one of the major problems with this, you know, sort of SCADA industry is that there are a bunch of proprietary protocols and nothing talks to each other, right?
The main problem.
Okay.
So a company like Clarity and its competitors were born because of this spaghetti of protocols and devices that nobody could keep follow. Because in the past, SCADA networks were air-gapped. Nobody could talk to them. So there was not a security problem because nobody could reach out to these environments. But because of convergence, IT and OT kind of converge, and now you can access your OT devices from the internet. Ooh. Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah.
So the asset owners started needed a solution to understand what do they have in their network and how can they protect. So that's kind of how or why Clarity was born. But fast forward to my role, I needed to add support in different protocols that nobody knew how they work, and we only had the equipment in our lab. So we have a cool lab in Tel Aviv where we buy and plug in all the devices, and we need to research how these devices work and how the protocol works. So,
dude, I'm totally like geeking out right now about how amazing that job is. Like, what a breeding ground for a hacker, right? Like, you know,
yeah, for
you're
sure.
Just constantly reverse engineering protocols, you know, and it's like, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Exactly. So, I mean, this is where my curiosity reached its peak, because I needed to understand how a black box device that is managing, I don't know, let's say water utilities or our gas pipelines, which is super cool, how these devices controllers work and how I can operate these devices with these esoteric protocols, and I need to understand the protocols really good. So I did a bunch of reverse engineering into firmwares and embedded devices and protocol analysis and blind protocol analysis, where you have like these streams of bits and bytes, and you need to understand, okay, this is the header, this is the command. So that's really cool. So I started, really from the hands-on to understand how this protocol works. And, you know, while doing reverse engineering into the main functions of firmwares, I started to see some, buffer overflows potentials. So I created like a small POC Python script that overflows the stack, and suddenly the device crashed. And we're talking about controllers that actually, transform or generate responsible for generation of electricity. I mean, that's super scary.
Yeah.
This controller like move up and down the elevator. So,
dude, they talk about like impact, right? Like,
you know, exactly.
We talk
exactly.
about like, oh yeah, you know, your database is going to see like a, you know, performance deficit, and they're like, your elevator will literally drop. Like, you know, like
yeah. I mean, I can shut down, and I did this before. I can shut down like entire buildings. So modern cities and modern buildings have these tons of BMS system, building management systems. So the HVAC is fully controlled. All the doors are fully remotely controlled. All the gas and pipelines and the water, everything is managed by, you know, Ethernet protocols. And I had the chance, the opportunities to shut down an entire building. Nobody can go up or down the elevator. Nobody can exit the doors.
Oh, my God, dude.
That's crazy.
Have you ever seen the movie National Treasure with Nicolas Cage?
Yeah,
this is like you. This is like, so when I was a kid, I was like, oh man, like I see this guy Riley, you know, or whatever, the guy, the hacker in that movie, right? That like helps the dude steal the Constitution or whatever. And I was like, that's the guy that I want to be, you know. He's like, all right, I'm in the system. I'm like locking the doors.
Exactly.
And that's exactly
and you'd
what
be
doing.
Surprised. And you'd be surprised. You know, the only thing that prevents you from doing that is getting access to these platforms, which is very expensive. But since I work in this company that our forte is those systems, I get access to these type of systems, and there are tons of bugs over there.
Dude.
Tons of bugs, from web bugs to binary exploitation bugs to there are tons of bugs that are just waiting for researchers to find, because nobody can access this equipment because it's expensive.
I have to say, like, normally when I think about my job, you know, I'm like, I don't have a lot of job envy. Like, I'm like, man, you know, professional live hacking event participant, self-employed, doing this podcast is exactly what I want to be doing. That is really cool. Like, that actually gives me a little bit of job envy right there, where you just got like this whole playground of toys, you know, that are used to control real buildings and real like physical systems that you get to hack.
Wow, I mean, dude. It's cool. I've been doing this for a long time. So
yeah.
Maybe we'll get back to the story. So I started as a protocol analyst. I did a lot of reverse engineering into firmwares to understand how this protocol works. And, I added visibility into our product. That means, we see this stream of bytes. This actually means move the elevator one level up, right?
Mm.
So you can take it to BMS, building management systems. You can take it to oil and gas, you know, like open the valve, close the valve. So every physical command has its equivalent in the network protocol. And this is what I needed to understand. So it was very cool. I learned a lot from it. Most of my embedded knowledge is from this type of work. But as I said, with time, I started to understand, okay, this is the main switch of all the commands, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's 0x0f, this means this is a move the elevator up. But then I see, okay, if there is more data in the packet than the buffer is allocated, you can achieve buffer overflow and then take control over some kind of flow, the code flow, like the instruction pointer of the device, and then you can achieve remote code execution. So I started to notice a lot of this because, again, no researcher ever looked at these devices.
Right.
These type of bugs
untouched.
Are not complicated.
Yeah.
Exactly, untouched, like a blue ocean, virgin territory. So I just started to report these bugs to Siemens, to Rockwell, to Schneider, to ABB, to all the great names that actually are the majority of the critical infrastructure vendors of the modern times. And they started to fix it, you know. So with time, I reached to like 30 CVEs, 50 CVEs.
Wow, dude.
And again, just because I had the opportunity to work on this, in this unfamiliar territory that nobody looked before. And so I opened the vulnerability research team at Clarity with the main focus of, okay, here is the lab, go over all the devices, find all the bugs you can, report it to the vendors and work with them to issue patches, because eventually our customers are using these products and we want our customers to be secure.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, you know, okay, so it went from you originally reverse engineering these protocols to integrate it into the product to now we're running the research team, the security team, because our customers are using these products and they need to be secured. Wow.
Exactly.
Dude, that is amazing. I got goosebumps a little bit, man. That's amazing. No, that is super cool.
That's like the transition I was fortunate enough to experience. And now, you know, the vulnerability research grew and grew and grew. Now I'm managing the department of research. We call ourselves Team 82. This is like our external brand name of the research team. We do a lot of OT hacking, which is a SCADA. I can deep dive into OT if you'd like. And we also do IoT because we grew and grew with time. So now we do more devices, like medical devices. For example, we're writing exploits to hack a patient monitor, you know, to change the heartbeat.
Dude, no, that's crazy. I saw one of your demos, you know, live, I think on a stage with your hacking a medical device that was like literally connected to your arm.
That's cool. I mean, again, it's not complicated. And I think the fact that it's not very complicated pushed me into bug bounties.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to ask as well. And I you know, okay, I've fanboyed enough a little bit now. I'll try not to give you too big of a head, you know, but that is really cool.
Thank you, man.
But yeah, let's talk about the nuts and bolts of it, right? So, you know, you're in this environment, you keep on saying, okay, a lot of times these, you know, SCADA systems are untouched, right? They're not really vetted for security problems, right? And so obviously that's the opposite of what you experience whenever you work on like a bug bounty program that's hardened, you know? So what brought you into the bug bounty world, and how has that been going from something that's very low level and very black box to something that is definitely very hardened?
Yeah. It's a good question. So, I mean, with time that you exploit a lot of different devices, you start to understand the pattern, like how the device and the firmware and the logic is built. Like what crossed through the developer's mind when they built the product, and what kind of checks they're doing, and what kind of checks they're probably missing. So I think if you take this experience from kind of a gray box testing, you know, black box, white box, you don't have the full code, but you can do some reverse engineering of the firmware, you start to understand the patterns that you're looking for in other platforms. And so I think the transition is kind of makes sense when you kind of understand, or at least think that you understand, what types of checks are usually overlooked. You start from these points that you try to poke at different areas of the platform or the logic to try to do it black box wise.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so then, you know, when you're moving into something like pwn to own, you know, are you seeing what is the difficulty level differential there? Like, cause you said before a lot of these are untouched, and then you go into something like pwn to own where there's a lot of researchers hacking on the same stuff.
Right.
You know, that difficulty level goes up a lot, I'd imagine.
So I agree with you. So what happened is we did in our team, we did a lot of exploitation of SCADA devices and a little bit of IoT devices. And then we saw Pontuon. So this was a great opportunity for us to start trying like the real world stuff. Here in our lab, we have these devices that probably nobody touched, but let's try to take a real challenge into devices that targets that ZDI, Zero Day Initiative, are specifically targeting because they're popular, because everybody are looking at them. And we had a great success. So Pontuon, let's talk a little bit about Pontuon. So Pontuon has this 304 themes of competitions. The first one is the classic one where they have the operating system and browsers competition, which we're not competing yet. That's super intense. And then they have the IoT competition, the ICS competition, which they stopped doing, and they also now started with the automotive competition. So we mainly focused on the other three, so the automotive, IoT, and the ICS or OT. By the way, just for terminology, OT, operational technology, ICS, industrial control systems. So we're talking about
I didn't know OT. OT, that's interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Operational technology. This is like, it's like IT, but with operational, with something physical.
Sure.
So we're talking about SCADA, like devices that have some kind of interface with
physical,
the physical world.
With the world. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
So we focused mostly on the ICS and IoT, and we had a great success. And if we're getting back to your question, like how difficult it is. So yeah, it's much more difficult. The attack surface is very limited and many eyes review it a lot of times. But still, we had some success, which was great. And we actually did five times of different Pontuons.
Wow, man, that's so fun. That's so fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is a lot of fun. So showing your exploit live is really cool.
Dude, that's got to be really nerve-wracking too. If it's like this one moment of like, does the exploit work? Does the exploit not work?
Everything comes down into one.
Oh my gosh, dude. Okay, so then let's kind of talk about Pontuon versus the HackerOne Live hacking events, and then we'll rewind a little bit into some of your bug bounty experience before that. So, you said at these Pontuon competitions, ZDI is selecting these targets that are specifically used because they're specifically selected because they're popular, right? And these are going to be more hardened because more eyes have been on them naturally. There's more time required for these events. And that's one of the things that I've seen between HackerOne's live hacking events and Pontuon's competitions, is that there's a massive time component that difference, right? HackerOne, it's normally you've got like 2 weeks to hack these companies or these devices or whatever. And then ZDI, I don't even know how far in advance do they do it?
Usually 3 months.
3 months. Wow. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, can you give me a little bit of a timeline on how that works? I mean, I'm sure it varies from product to product, but do you spend 3 months focusing on one product? Do you do 1 month, 1 month, 1 month, or like, how does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. So usually, I'm doing Pontuon with my team.
Right.
So usually we're 3 to 5.
Okay.
Depends on availability. So 3 months ahead of time, Pontuon or ZDI, they released the target list. And let's say we're talking about the IoT competition. So you have like the router category, and you have the NAS devices category, and you have smart cameras category. So different categories, and you have a bunch of devices with a price tag. So if you are able to exploit a IP camera remotely, specific one, you get the 30K, for example. So what myself and my team are doing, we're taking this list, and we're starting to do some async on all the devices. How easy it is to get the firmware, how many previous CVEs and bugs were reported, how many times this device was targeted in previous Pontuons. And we have these metrics where we decide on what targets we want to focus on.
Have you actually quantified it like that? Like, you've got this matrix and it's like, all right, it's been targeted at one pwn to own. So that's like a, you know, 0.8 yeah. multiplier or something like that. Like,
yeah. I mean, it's not very mathematical, yeah. but yeah, we have these categories or parameters you can call. So what's the price tag? How easy it is to get the device? How easy it is to extract the firmware, which is a really important factor, to be honest.
Yeah.
And how many times was it targeted before, and how many CVEs you have? So I'm running this random.
I love that it's actually like you have metrics for this, and you're making a choice based off of a procedure.
We must have this because you have like 20 or 30 targets, and you have to be very, very specific, because you can spend like a year on a target. For example, the guys that are doing the Tesla components, ECUs, are spending like a year on these exploits. Mm-hmm. And we want to be very focused because we have 3 months and we want to get as much as devices as we can. And usually we're able to get like 5 or 6 devices in this time frame. So we have to be very focused.
Let me ask you this. So there's a sort of a problem that I run into with these live hacking events, which is sometimes I want to win the live hacking event and I want to come in first, right? Yeah. And sometimes I want to make as much money as I can. And those don't necessarily, collide always, right? Like for example, on the HackerOne live hacking events, when it's multi-target, to get the MVH, you kind of have to hack both targets. But if you want to make the most money, in my experience, it's best to pick one target, go super deep, destroy it, like find a bunch of criticals and that sort of thing. Right. So when you're going into the pwn to own competitions, like what is your goal, or what is your team's goal typically for these things?
Yeah. So typically, we are taking into consideration the amount of money and points, because pwn to own are separating the points and the money, and the winner is the one with the most points and not money. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly the kind of the questions that the competitors are pondering. Like, we want more points or more money. Mm-hmm. So we usually tend towards the points. Mm. Like, we want to get higher on the table rather than money. But I guess it changes. It fluctuates between competitions.
And is this something you're doing as a part of Team 82, or like as a part of your job, or is this something you're doing sort of after hours with the team from work?
It's kind of a mix. I'd say we're doing this as Team 82. We're competing as Team 82.
Right.
But during these times of the year, we are spending a lot of more time than usual, and we also need to do our like day to day job, like usual job. Mm-hmm. So it's always like overtime, I'd say.
It's good PR for the company as well, if you guys are going out there destroying those targets. So I guess I wonder how much. So the prize money, then, does that go to the company or does that go to the team?
So we're kind of splitting it through the team.
Okay, nice.
But evenly, because we're all putting the same amount of effort into the targets, into the research. Sometimes we're building custom tools for that. Mm.
Yeah, I imagine you're doing a lot of building custom tools when you have these proprietary protocols and like that sort of thing.
We have to because... just like let's take an example from the web hacking. Sometimes you have like a target that you want to scan it across the entire internet, and you want to do some kind of specific logic. And so it's kind of the same with firmware. Sometimes you want to poke the firmware. You want to, for example, ask questions about all the functions, like what kind of functions contain this specific code flow that I might abuse somehow. Mm. So yeah, we're building like custom scripts, custom tools to ask and answer these specific questions.
Okay, so let me double click into that for a second. So what is your go-to language and like some packages that you use for a lot of this stuff?
So I usually exclusively use Python and Bash for scripting. It's
my man. Okay, I love it.
It's the fastest way to move forward. Mm. And I'd say that for kind of packages for Python, you have the pwn one.
Yeah, the pwn tools or whatever. Yeah,
pwn tools. For easy interaction with the targets, I'd say, you know, sending payloads, receiving payloads, stuff like that.
Yeah, I'll drop that in the notes for those people that are interested in that. Yeah, no, I've seen that, and I haven't used it super much. I've done a lot of, I guess most of the binary stuff that I've done has only been very limited, so I haven't had the chance to use it extensively, but it seems very, very useful.
It's very useful.
Yeah.
It just contains all the you know, go-to functions, you know, conversion between different big endian, little endian, and you have a hex formats, and it's very convenient to use it.
Yeah.
Very easy.
That seems to be the case. So one of the questions we put in the doc here was like, all right, give me the Sharon, you know, breakdown on what HackerOne is doing right with the life hacking events and what they're doing wrong versus what Pontone is doing, right? So let me get your opinion on that, and then we'll talk about a couple of those as well.
Yeah, sure. So again, you know, these type of competitions are completely different. So in HackerOne live hacking events, you have like two weeks of preparation, and then the live event is like 48 hours max for hacking.
Yeah.
So you don't have a lot of time to go very deep. So it's more, for me at least, it's more of a social event, right? It's more of a community wise. You get to know a lot of different people and maybe to do some collabs with them. So it's really great to know a lot of people from the industry. While Pwn to Own, so you spend 3 months by yourself at home alone
in the dark in the dungeon,
in the dark. and then you go for 1 or 2 days and just show your exploit and that's it. So it's much less of a community event, much less of kind of a social event. I mean, you do get to know people there, but it's much less focused on community. But it's much more deep dive. So we have one target, like one device or two devices, and you do a deep dive into that. You know all the firmware by heart. You know all the functions. You know all the interfaces. You know all the attack vectors on it. So it's much, much more deep dive. Also, in Pwn to Own, so ZDI folks are running Pwn to Own. And they are super technical. They're hackers themselves, and they do a lot of hacking themselves. So they understand the research that you provide them.
That's so
really
cool.
Good. And they will fight for you with the vendor. So this is amazing. So, for example, let's say that I was able to demonstrate a successful exploit at Pwn to Own. And for some reason, the vendor does not agree with that. So ZDI will fight for you. They will shove it into the vendor and we'll tell them you need to fix it no matter what. And this is great because it really pushes the entire industry, the entire industry forward, because ZDI puts a lot of pressure into vendors to make things right, and they fight for their researchers, and I really appreciate that.
It just warms the heart, doesn't it, when you see like your advocate out there being like, no, this is fire, this is a great exploit, you need to fix it.
You know, I'll give you a contra for that. So sometimes I'm submitting bugs to H1 and it's like, it feels to me like a flip of a coin that it will be, I'm submitting it as critical and it will be closed as informative.
So
when I submit bugs to ZDI and Pwn to Own, I know they will get it. I know they will do the right thing and push the vendor.
One of the most challenging things with HackerOne and BugCrowd and Integrity is like they have so much volume that they have this massive triager problem to solve, right? And the triagers burn out pretty quickly, so it's hard to keep like, you know, high quality triagers on the team and stuff like that. So you do run into those issues. And I will say, I haven't experienced the Pwn to Own side, and I'm sure that would be so heartwarming to see them fighting for your bug. But I have had a couple experiences with HackerOne. I think it's like maybe the top 300 researchers or something like that on HackerOne get access to this thing called an HSM, Hacker Success Manager. And they're the person that I ping when I run into that sort of problem, right? Like, oh, my report got closed as informative. Hey man, this is not informative. Can you like take care of that? And then, you know, and it happens. So, and when it does, I'm like, I'm so pleased by that. That just makes me so happy. It feels so appreciated.
Exactly. So the problem is volume. I totally agree. I mean, when you have a lot of volume, especially new hackers coming in and just like pushing bugs without understanding. But I think that I understand the HSM thing, but I think that hackers with more credibility to their name and more mileage, their assessment of bugs needs to be a little bit different. That's my take on it.
I totally agree. I wish there was I mean, obviously there's the reputation metrics and stuff like that, but that doesn't correlate with hackers that are new to the HackerOne platform, but very experienced hackers. So there needs to be some sort of, I guess, premium onboarding or something like that for hackers that have experience on other platforms or in other competitions or something like that.
I had a case. I mean, it's a very interesting one. I had a case when I submitted a bug as high, I think, and it was closed by the triager. It was closed as informative. He told me it's not interesting.
I could feel my pulse just like, that just gets you in the heart, doesn't it, when they do that?
I was new on the platform, and then I wrote like, oh, I'm sorry, I will not submit this type of bug anymore. And then the vendor reopened the case, assigned it as high, and paid the bounty. And I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I love your response, dude. Your response is like, oh, okay, my bad. You know, no, I'll just take this high or critical exploit and just, you know, okay, I guess it's not real. Oh man, no, you got to fight. And that's what I tell people when they go to these live hacking events is like, that's one of the best things about being in person at the live hacking events is like, if you've got some bug that's being, incorrectly the severity assigned classified. To it, classified, then you can just go knock on the triage door and say like, you know, hey, I need to talk to somebody from the team or from triage, and I need to explain how this bug works. And you can just sit down with them in person and be like, hey, here's the exploit. Clearly, this is a problem. You know,
it is. Yeah. It is.
And so,
but again, I do understand the volume issue. I mean,
yeah. It's
it is what it is.
It is. Let me talk about this, because there's two main things that I think I'd like to discuss about Pwn2Own versus HackerOne here that we've got left. One is that Pwn2Own only does pre-auth RCE, and I think that leaves a lot on the table. What are your thoughts on that? Having been in the HackerOne environment now, where other types of exploits are also appreciated.
So again, Pwn2Own is very exclusive competition. Mm-hmm. They want, they want to do kind of a POC or mm-hmm. get a fuck out, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they want pre-auth RCE. They want you to run code on this device, mm-hmm. Preferably as root, mm-hmm. Or it's not interesting. Mm-hmm. Why it's not interesting? Because this is not part of the competition, the Pwn2Own. Mm-hmm. Pwn2Own.
Yeah, exactly.
You need to own the device, right? So that's the competition. While they do understand there is a lot of attack surface, and you know, while we're targeting five devices when we're preparing for Pwn2Own, and you know, we have like five pre-auth RCEs, we have like 50 different bugs that are not included in the competition, and we're submitting that later on to ZDI, and they accept them, they process them, and they make the vendor fix them. So that's fine. I mean, that's part of the competition, but in the competition itself, they only want pre-auth RCE because that's the rules of the competition. HackerOne, live hacking events, they have this range, you know, low, medium, high, critical, because they understand that actual targets have different attack surface and they want all of it.
So yeah, and that is the case. I'm wondering if you were to build your perfect live hacking competition, what would you do? You know, would you, given the opportunity, say, okay, Pwn2Own should accept something like arbitrary account takeover, where you can just get into any device and take over people's account, or like DOSes that take down the whole service, right, where the device becomes inaccessible. Those are very impactful bugs, and I'm wondering whether you think those should be like what happens to those bugs? Because inevitably you stumble upon them, right? When you're trying to find these pre-auth RCEs, so I mean, you just report them to the vendor and you don't get any money for them.
So you can. So if you have bugs that you found and you did not use them through Pwn2Own, you can still submit them to ZDI. You can actually. So ZDI are purchasing bugs. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of their business model. They pay for vulnerabilities because ZDI are owned by Trend Micro, mm-hmm. the the AV company.
Yeah.
Or EDR now, I'm not sure. and so ZDI wants to get the new exploits, the new bugs, the new vulnerabilities, and they will purchase them from researchers, and they will submit them to the vendors. And this is where they're really useful in fighting with the vendors and push them into fixing the security vulnerabilities. And then Trend Micro will develop detection. So this is kind of their business model. So if you find bugs that are not pre-auth RC, you can still use them. You can still sell them to ZDI.
Okay. Okay. That's cool. And do they pay out all right?
Yeah. Yeah. They pay great. I mean, they don't have like a predefined metrics table.
Like a bounty
for
table
parsing.
Or whatever. Okay.
The bounty table. Yeah. But they pay great. And they also have tiers. So you can move forward with reputation, and as long with more bugs that you're selling them and more reputation, you actually move forward just like a freaking flyer. Yeah.
Wow.
So we have like silver, bronze, I forgot the tiers, but
yeah.
And you get multipliers. So yeah, they have a great program for that.
Dang, that sounds pretty awesome. I wasn't aware of that aspect to it. I think I got to look into that a little bit more. Do you ever run into scenarios where like you're hacking a target and you just find like an absolute shit ton of mediums and highs that are not pre-auth RC, or even criticals that are not pre-auth RC, right? And then those earnings from reporting those bugs to ZDI outweigh the money that you make from submitting the pre-auth RCEs?
So myself, I mean, that's not the case for myself at least, but I do know some other folks that are doing a lot of fuzzing and they're fighting a lot of lows and mediums by fuzzing different file types and protocols. And yeah, they do a bunch of money for that.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Yeah, I gotta think about that. Alrighty, Richard, what's on the docket for today? Oh, an ASMR ad? Say less. I got you. All right, guys. So today we're gonna attack surface management roles, not AS. Okay, I got you. Well, if we're talking about attack surface management, then of course we're talking about the Acinode team, right? The OGs in the ASM space. And this time around, they've released a new community project, their attack surface management job board, a place where you can see all of the companies that are hiring for attack surface management jobs. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, if you're a recon heavy hacker, or if you just want to get your hands on the Acinode product to play around with it, then definitely check out that job board. That's going to be at acinode.io/ASMR. I'm going to make them change it to ASMR. So if you want to support the pod, or if you want to check out that job board, head over to acinode.io/ASMR. All right, back to the show. Let's go. Okay, we spent a good amount of time on the live hacking event flow and that whole thing now. So let's jump a little bit more into your methodology, okay?
Cool.
So obviously, you know, you've got this IoT ICS hacking side, and you've got this, you know, web hacking side. How do you the one I'm more interested in picking your brain on is this IoT hacking side. So what is the overall methodology when you get a new device? How important is, you know, getting firmware, getting a dynamic debugger, that sort of thing? And what is your approach?
Yeah, cool. So whenever you research IoT or OT devices, you know, controllers and stuff like that, the most important thing is obviously to get the firmware. And getting the firmware, there are multiple ways to get the firmware. If it's super easy, sometimes you can download it from the vendor's website, you know, because they offer it to their customers. In most cases, it's not plain text, so it's encrypted. And then you have like different methodologies of how to handle that. Sometimes the vendor offers to download previous versions of the firmware too, and then you go one by one until you find an encrypted one, decrypted one, and inside the transition firmware will contain also the algorithm and the key for the encrypted one.
Dude, right? that is a good tip right there. So at some point, if they switch from non-encrypted to encrypted, go back to the last version. Wow. Uh-huh.
Because somehow the current firmware needs to understand how to install the encrypted one, how to decrypt and install the new firmware, right? So we go one by one until we found this transition firmware, and then we develop the decryption process ourselves.
Wow.
Sometimes if you are able to exploit a current device and research its binaries. And then you can get root access to the device and then explore and research the binaries, and you'll find the decryption procedure mm-hmm. in these binaries. Mm-hmm. So you can take it to decrypt the firmwares. And sometimes if you have no luck, you need to desolder the flash chip and right. rid the firmware out of the device itself.
That's so much. It's so much work to do that, right? That's one of the things with IoT devices that hurts me a little bit as a web hunter, because like as a web hunter, I can go focus on some of these high dollar, you know, web paying programs and pop some bugs that are going to pay really great bounties, or I can spend a week, you know, like.
But think about it. Think about it like this. What if you could spend a lot of time to get the source code of the server
It'd be so worth it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So if you get the firmware, it's not a black box anymore. It becomes a gray box. Mm. So obviously, if you want to be successful with embedded devices, you need to get the firmwares, and usually these are the three methods: like download from the vendor's website, find the transition between the encrypted and decrypted. Hack the device itself by finding kind of post of remote code executions, black box wise, sometimes it's possible, and then get the binaries, extract the decryption process and implement it, or desolder the flash chip and read the firmware out of the device. So
nice.
Once you have the firmware, you're in a great position to start researching the platform itself.
So you've got the firmware, you know, do you normally work on a live device or do you try to get that firmware emulated?
So it's a great question. We usually start from emulation because
That's cool.
Sometimes the device, you cannot buy the device. It's expensive. It will take a lot of time, to reach us. So we're starting from emulation because it helps us to get ourselves familiar with the environment. Like, what do we need to patch in order to make it work? What are the main binaries? How the operating system and the file system is arranged? So it gives us a lot of hard work, but it's worth it because after emulating the device, we, in most cases, understand really good the environment and how it works, like from the inside.
Yeah.
But in many cases, we also purchase the device, and we work on a real device.
Yeah, dude, that's super badass, man. You know, like I would love to have an emulated environment for some of these IoT devices that I've hacked on, because it's such a pain when you like mess something up and you're gonna like, all right, I gotta unplug it and plug it back in and wait for it to reboot. And if I could just go, exactly. boop, you know, just rewind it.
So we create Docker files and then you can just reboot it.
So the most experience that I've had with this is like taking a binary, put it in QEMU and like do a little bit of work on it because of the situation that we were in. So what does it look like to pull the firmware off of a device and have all these different partitions, and you've got just like your IMG file or whatever, right? This like raw DD that you pulled off the device, and then get that into an emulator and emulate all these different partitions and align everything so that the thing actually starts up when you boot it.
Yeah, so not necessarily you'll need all the file system. So sometimes you want only a specific binary that is responsible for the main logic. Let's take example, IoT device, let's say a camera. Most of the camera's logic will be implemented in one binary. You don't need all the partitions and everything. You just need this one binary to work. So
but doesn't it crash all the time if you don't have like, I'd imagine that's the case, but maybe that's not the case.
So you start, you know, you start from, okay, just the binary itself, and then it doesn't work. Why?
Sure.
Because it's looking for these and that libraries. Okay, so you take all the, you extract all the libraries, and you place it in the right place, and then you iterate through this process until the binary works. And you just work with one binary and all the peripherals. So you don't need all the file system in most cases, right?
Yeah, dude, I guess that's one of those things that you just, like, I wouldn't have tried. Because I would have assumed it's too piecemeal, where it's like, oh, I got to get this piece. And then, you know, then I hit like this sub part of the application and it freaks out because I'm missing this folder and, you know.
Yeah, obviously, sometimes you need to patch the binary itself, you know, because let's say it's looking for a very specific component, hardware component that you don't have because it's emulation and it's not implemented yet in QMU. So you patch this this part to just work, like return zero or something, if it's not important for the device itself.
Yeah. Wow. You really have to get in the weeds with that binary then and understand
you have to really understand what it's doing, and you have to reverse engineer it really good to understand what it's supposed to do, why. For example, let's talk about the patient monitor, for example.
Yeah.
So for the main logic of the entire patient monitor, at least in the case that I researched, it was implemented in one binary. But this binary had a lot of communication, you know, serial communication to peripherals of the patient monitor, the SpO2, like the O2 levels of your blood. So we just patched all of these functions, and the device thought, here is the O2 read. It's like 98% all the time, right? It doesn't really matter.
This patient
is
super consistent. Like, they're always at 98%.
So by binary patching, you can actually skip a lot of the checks and a lot of the hurdles that a real device, like simulating a real device. Yeah.
Wow. And when you're going about that, how are you doing these binary patches?
So usually you work with IDA or Ghidra. So you just look at the functions and you see it's reading from a serial bus. Usually it's from a specific device, or for example, from RS-245 or whatever, and you just patch this type of functionality.
And does Ghidra and IDA have functionality built into the applications to do that, or are you just opening up in a hex editor and then modifying it afterwards?
It doesn't really matter. I usually use a hex editor, but I mean, both Ghidra and IDA have this functionality. Binary patch it. I'm just old school. I'm using hex editor.
Yeah, that's the only thing I've done with binary patching, just very limited hex editor. Let me modify this like string or tweak this one little flow.
It sounds, to be honest, it sounds intimidating, but in reality, it's very simple. You just skip a function. You just nope a function and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. It is intimidating, but it is doable. And I have to say, like, the scenario in which I did it was there was this binary that was being loaded up by a mobile app that I needed to modify a little piece of. And I was like racking my head. I was like, man, I can't get this to work with Frida. You know, like why can't I hook it? Oh, it's in the native binary. Oh, this is such a pain. And then my buddy was like, man, you should just like patch the binary, you know, the .so file. And I was like, you know, dude, that sounds really painful. And like 15 minutes later, it was done. You know, it's not that bad if you know exactly where you need to modify.
Exactly.
So that is pretty rad. That is something you just got to take the deep dive on and do it, I think.
Definitely. And again, emulating devices, I think it's worth the time. Again, we're not emulating the entire device and not the entire peripheral, just the logic itself that we're focused on.
That's a great piece of advice. I think that's something that I'll try next time around is, you know, when I get the firmware off, I'll try to put it into, maybe I'll allocate a day to it or something like that, of trying to get that, you know, identify the main binary, the main functionality, and then just get all of the peripherals that it needs. I know this probably varies from you know, project to project, from target to target, but how long does it take typically for you to, let's say you pulled firmware, how long does it take for you to get it spun up in QMU or whatever?
So it really depends how complex the device is. So for example, the patient monitor that I talked about, it had a lot of peripherals. So we needed to patch it one by one and understand how it works one by one. So it took some time. It took a couple of days. But sometimes, especially if we're talking about routers, that QMU has some initial support for a lot of them, it's really easy. You can get a firmware and start working with QMU in a couple of hours.
Wow, dude. Yeah, that's a good piece for the hacker one, you know, people listening, is like, you know, a lot of times if we're in the competitions, we don't have a lot of time and we're like, is this worth my time to actually get an emulation environment set up? But if you can get it set up in a couple hours, totally worth it, you know, for sure. And then you got dynamic debugging and it's like, it's beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. And you can reboot it anytime. You can change it. You can modify it. You can patch some functionality that you're not interested in. You can bypass anti-debugging techniques. Yeah
set great. Up some fuzzing easy. It's great. Okay, cool. So that's those are some awesome takeaways. My favorite ones from that was the unencrypted version to the encrypted version.
The transition, transition version. Yeah,
I love that. That is great, man. Okay, so let's talk about I guess the one of the main areas that you focus on, and which is the IoT communications with the mothership, you know, with the cloud, yeah, so to speak. That's something that we also had another researcher, Matt Brown, come on and talk about recently. And so whenever I hear, you know, two hackers that I respect talk about the same thing at the same time, I'm like, look, this is something we need to really deep dive and understand thoroughly. So what does that process look like? How are you normally going about it, setting up, you know, middleman for those communications, and what kind of protocols and patterns do you see?
Yeah, so, you know, whenever we're researching a device, about modern devices, they're not standalone. Mm-hmm. They usually communicate with some kind of a cloud. I call this a cloud, like a main server, mothership, mm-hmm, whatever you want to call
sure
it. And they exchange data. What kind of data they exchange? For example, normally modern devices will be managed by a user account. So you have your account, you can log in from your mobile application, and then through the cloud to device, you can control it. And we are very interested in this type of communication, because if we could do account takeover or device takeover, the terminology is not invented yet, I guess.
These are new vuln classes, really, in this scenario. Yeah.
Yeah. So instead of controlling your device, you're actually controlling another device, and then you can interact with it through the cloud. So you don't have to be in the same network, local area network, with this device, and you can actually bypass firewalls and not segregation and control remotely devices. So that's a very powerful.
That's the
primitive
end of the world, man. That is like the
exactly
the holy grail of like. Like, and I think in one of your I think it was one of your DEF CON talks, you guys talked about a scenario with a couple devices, actually, where you're able to like emulate, you know, impersonate the device to the cloud, push a config up, and then pull yourself out. So it pushes that config back down to the actual device. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is so bad.
So I think in many cases, the device to cloud communication is overlooked by developers because they focus on the user to cloud functionality and they do a lot of checks over there. So are you accessing the right device, you know, role permissions and account permissions and 32 character long password
that
will not protect you from anything. But the device itself, the functionality that is loaded into the device that communicates to the cloud, in many cases, unfortunately, this is overlooked because developers are not considering this.
They don't expect you to see it.
Attack vector.
Yeah.
Because they kind of say to themselves, I guess, okay, what happens if someone impersonates a device? Nothing. Right, but that's not the reality, because if you can impersonate a device and you can actually tell the cloud to change configuration about yourself as a device, in many cases this could lead to a device takeover, that you can actually add this device to your attacker's account and then take over devices that did not belong to you.
Yeah, dude, that's awesome. and so I'm wondering, what is that flow look like for you? Like, you know, how do you get the man in the middle set up in place? Like, I think Matt Brown has like some script he runs, like Midim router or something like that, or some people use like a Wi-Fi pineapple. What are you using for that?
So again, it depends the project, mm-hmm, but usually what I do is I have my own kind of router, mm-hmm, that I can fully control, mm-hmm, and I place it before the device itself. Mm-hmm. And then since I'm the router, I control the DHCP, I control the DNS, mm-hmm, I control the traffic. What I usually do is I do a HTTPS downgrade attack. So usually, mm-hmm, I'm converting everything into HTTP. And again, you can do it by multiple ways. For example, you can inject your CA into the device. Mm-hmm. You can, if there is a cert pin inside the logic, you can patch it to accept your certificate, your CA. Mm. And basically what I try to do is I try to make sure that the communication is HTTP and not HTTPS, and then it's really easy to do a man in the middle and intervene in the communication.
So if you're doing I'm not super familiar with the flow for a downgrade attack. Are you doing something you know, patching something at the binary level to just make it HTTP rather than HTTPS, or are you actually like getting an HTTPS server that it trusts, you know, and you're man in the middle in that with a trusted certificate and then, you know, redirecting to HTTP?
So we can double down on that. So there are multiple scenarios. Mm-hmm. The first scenario is there is hard coded, is a configuration for the main binary that mm-hmm. needs to communicate with the server, right? And you simply change in the configuration, you change the address from HTTPS cloud to HTTP cloud, and you're done. And in other scenarios, this is not a configuration. This is actually being downloaded from the cloud as configuration. So you find a way to intervene, maybe in the memory, maybe you're doing some binary patching, and change from HTTPS to HTTP.
Wow. Okay.
Okay, that's fine. Mm. And in other scenarios, you can actually use HTTPS and you just add your CA to the trusted CA store inside the device.
Oh yeah, of course. If you've got it emulated, you can just do that super easy.
And then you use the DNS server that you own to actually give the device whenever it requests to resolve the server, you give it your own address. And then since you are the server for the device right now and they trust your CA, then you can actually do SSL termination. Mm. And then the device communicates to your cloud, which is not a real cloud, with HTTPS, and then you do SSL termination, and you actually, from your device, your server, you communicate to the real cloud. And then you kind of do a real man in the middle.
Wow, cool. What kind of tools are you using for that SSL termination and that whole impersonation process?
So usually we have kind of Python scripts to do most of that.
custom stuff?
But again, you have like ready made tools like Man in the Middle. SSL is really great. But again, it really depends the project and how
things are set up.
Yeah, exactly, how things are set up.
Very cool, man. Okay, so you're man in the middle in that communication. Right. What kind of protocols are you seeing for that communication? Is it typically just hitting an HTTP API or what?
Again, we're talking about a broad variety of devices, but in most cases, it's HTTPS, and in some cases, you also have some proprietary protocols that are specific to some devices. But yeah, in most cases, it would be HTTPS, and all the device to cloud communication will go over the HTTPS, you know, to transfer configuration, to update, to do kind of a keep alive, to update the firmware, to do over the air updates. So most of the communication will be over HTTPS.
Gotcha. That makes sense. It sounds like so much fun, man. I think my favorite hacking experience overall was hacking an IoT device. Like, I've just had so much fun with that. So I think for me, it's a little bit hard to focus on hacking those devices with the opportunity cost of web, you know, and it being such my, you know, bread and butter, something that I can do pretty easily. But man, it's so fun
obviously it's different. It's a different speciality. One thing that is interesting to say that Pwn2Hone in the IoT theme competition, they have this cool smash up kind of a feature, you can call it, where they offer you 100K if you are able to exploit from the one into a router, and from the router exploit a local device, IoT device, like a camera.
Wow.
So if you're able to provide, to show, demonstrate a full exploit that you hack a router from the outside, from the one, and from inside, do what you want to do, and then hack and exploit a device, IoT device from the inside. And again, they have like a very specific target list for each LAN and WAN categories. They offer this. They offer you 100K.
Wow, dude, that's a pretty insane setup there. If you could literally just go from WAN to shell on an internal device, that's
exactly. And they do this because they want like the real experience.
Yeah.
They want the real thing. And it's great. We've been doing this. A couple of times. Yeah. I know that others, Synology did it also.
How often do people pull it off?
They started like, I think a year ago.
Okay.
So maybe maybe 5 or 10-ish so far.
Oh my gosh, dude, that's crazy. I went to a local talk in Richmond. We have a conference here in Richmond, Virginia, called RVA Sec. And one of the guys, I think one of the Tenable researchers who's actually done some Pwn Do and stuff, I think, was giving a presentation on like pwning all these routers that he does for his work stuff. And one of the things he was saying was that the WAN interfaces on these are a little bit whack sometimes because over IPv4, you know, you've got your firewalls IPv6. In place.
I know this guy. He did the IPv6 exploit.
Dude,
I remember him.
My mind was blown when he presented
yeah,
that.
Yeah, this is one of the things that is usually overlooked by kind of a low-tier router vendors that are not enterprise.
Right.
The IPv6 one, because there is a different IP table for IPv4 and IPv6. And usually whenever you configure the router to block or to do something with the IP table, usually developers will go to the IPv4 and they forget to configure the IPv6. And that's why sometimes you can communicate with routers from the WAN using IPv6, even though it needs to be blocked.
It's terrifying. That is absolutely terrifying, man. That you might be exposing services on your WAN side via IPv6.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh my
Think
gosh.
About kind of local only services that are supposed to be communicated only from the local area network are exposed on the WAN. Yeah, that's great.
Terrifying. Okay, so let's go back to that you know, man in the middle. And I know you know we were shooting for an hour. We're going a little long here. Is that okay with you?
yeah, I'm with you.
Dude, I'm into it, man. I'm still getting a ton out of this. So talk to me a little bit about how it works for you to impersonate devices to the cloud. What is your approach there? You know, obviously you get the man in the middle in place. What kind of trends do you see that people make mistakes on when securing that cloud to device communication?
Okay, so the thing about impersonating devices is to collect enough information about the device that will gain us the ability to impersonate it in front of the cloud. Now, think about it this way. So there is a vendor that manufactures a lot of devices, right? And they need to keep track of these devices on how, whenever they leave the factory, on how the devices can communicate with the mothership, with the cloud. So they have these unique identifiers that tells the cloud, device presents to the cloud this unique identifier. You can call it a token, you can call it a serial, you can call it a combination of serial and MAC, something that the cloud will be able to verify that, yes, this is a real authentic device that left our factory. And in some cases, these identifiers are not unique enough and are not strong enough. So in some cases, you can brute force them, you can you can guess them or you can come up with your identifiers that the cloud will trust you to be an authentic device. Now, the thing is, what if you're able to get identifiers of another device that does not belong to you? Like your device is ABC and you're able to get a device that is identifier is XYZ. Then you can take these identifiers, you can even plug it into your device and then communicate to the cloud, and the cloud will think, oh, okay, this device is not ABC, this is XYZ.
Oh my gosh.
And it has this scenario that I'm describing, it has some implications on how the cloud is communicating to the device, because right now, the user of the device that owns XYZ will communicate to your device. Because the cloud thinks that XYZ is this device that just a moment before it was ABC. And this cross interactions between different devices and different users, we found multiple ways to abuse this into device cross account takeover. So I can give you a couple of examples.
Yeah.
So for example, let's say the device is identified in front of the cloud using a serial and MAC. This is very common. Now the problem with the serial and MAC is MAC is very easy to brute force because the three first bytes are the vendor OUI. And then you have left only three bytes to brute force or to guess. And you also have a lot of, for example, if you go on eBay, you'll see a lot of pictures of devices and you'll see the MAC address and the serial on top of the device.
Oh, no. That's bad. Yeah.
So let's say you went on eBay, you saw a MAC address and a serial, or you saw some YouTube videos of folks doing kind of unboxing.
Unboxing or something. I love that attack vector. That's great.
Exactly. And you get the MAC and serial. So you take this MAC and serial, and it is being used like credentials to the cloud. And then you connect to the cloud. The cloud thinks that you are the device XYZ. Mm. And what you can do with that is, in some cases, you can, as the device, you can tell the cloud, I belong to this user, right? So what you do is you take the credential, the serial and MAC of some device, and then you tell it, yeah, I actually belong to the attacker's account. And then suddenly in the attacker's account, they get a new device.
Oh my gosh.
So this scenario, it sounds ridiculous, but unfortunately, it's very common in IoT to do kind of account takeover.
Yeah.
So device takeover.
Device takeover and then correlate it with the account. That's with the attacker's
exactly.
account. That's a good flow. And I'm wondering whether you think the correlation of these devices, you know, to your account and it, like being able to do that from something that is on the outside of the box or on the outside of the router, like, is that always insecure because of this unboxing scenario? Because that's a great point. I mean, these are influencers too, right? You know, like these are high value targets for attackers. And if they're flipping the device over and that sort of thing, and that sort of information can be leaked just from an external perspective of the device, right. That's a problem, I think, right?
It is. It is a problem. And again, not all devices are insecure in that manner, mm-hmm. but the modern devices, like the protected or secure devices, use strong identifiers that it's impossible to brute force or to guess or to view from the outside because they will use some kind of internal, in most cases, hardware-based identifier right. that cannot be guessed and cannot be used, like a private key. That is embedded inside the device itself in a special storage that cannot be easily accessed.
Yeah.
I mean, and even if it could be accessed, you'll need a lot of effort and physical access to the device in order to get it. And usually it will be burned into the device through the factory manufacturing process.
Mm, mm. And like some sort of you know, secure enclave or like what are the other ways that they store this information?
Exactly, secure enclave. Yeah. Usually modern approach is OTP fuse. Mm. So it's like one-time programming fuse memory that is one-time programming, like written once and that's it. You cannot write to it anymore. And only the device, the internal architecture of the device can use this information as the identifier or kind of an internal configuration that identifies this device only.
Wow, dude.
So actually device becomes, instead of just logically just a serial and MAC, it actually becomes part of the device itself, like hardware-wise.
Yeah.
So you need the PCB with the components soldered to it in order to impersonate the device.
So that makes sense. And I've got one more question here before we switch over to some of your other, you know, bug bounty related stuff. The randomness that's required to secure these devices, right? You know, say you've got a string, you know, maybe it's got like 900 million possibilities or whatever, right? Like that, I mean, if you've got a million devices, right? And you've got all the time in the world, that's still not secure enough, right? You need to have something that is massively random, especially if you've got a ton of devices in order.
Right.
So, I mean, if you see a hex string and it's just a hex string and it's not, you know, 20 characters long, then it's a problem.
It is. And and that's why modern devices will use a private key, 2048, a bit long at least. That's impossible to impersonate.
Yeah, wow. That for my like bug bounty brain, that's a little bit tricky because a lot of the times, you know, for us, we're talking about things that can be enumerated pretty quickly or used for an exploit in that regard. But when there's so many devices across the whole flow, that's different as well. Okay, so let's
2048 bit is enough.
Okay, great. I'll be on the lookout for that. So let's go into some of your let's jump over to some of your bug bounty stuff right now. And we put some questions in the doc here. And man, you really delivered some awesome questions on this one and good tips in the prep here. So I'm really excited to break these apart. One of the things you say your secret is being able to replicate a bunch of work done by others. And, right. You know, Sharon, I don't understand. How are you doing all this binary research and doing bug bounty and then also just on the side casually reproducing all of the bugs that come through your pipeline here? Like, talk to me about that. Like,
first of all, I'm flattered. Thank you. But first of all, I'm not young anymore.
Yeah.
I'm 30 year old. So I have around 15 years of experience a lot of time to try a bunch of different approaches and stuff.
You're still actively replicating bugs though, right? To this day?
Yeah. So what I try to do, so I wrote kind of like many others, I wrote like a small bot that will scout the internet and find me articles and interesting bugs according to some parameters. And I tried at least once a day to read one or two articles. Mm. In some topics, for example, a new method for fuzzing, right? Not statically fuzzing, but network-wise fuzzing. And then I try to replicate it and use it in my line of work. So I take it and I try to think, how can I use it in our own lab research? And the way that I replicate this research is kind of aligns with the stuff that I normally do. So this way, I'm able to also do the work that I need to do, but also improve it with innovative ways that others are finding. So,
wow.
I think this is I'm not sure if to say this is my secret, but I try to be very up to date with all the techniques, all the methods, all the new research, and try to implement it into my work.
You know, that's very different, man, than a lot of people, because a lot of people, they get to a certain point where they're having success. And then they just want to, they just like get addicted to that. And they're just like, oh, I just want to, I'm talking about myself as well. You know, I get addicted to finding these bugs in bug bounty and getting these, you know, big payouts and that sort of thing. And that's all I want to do with my time is pluck, 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 you know, keep on grabbing these IDORs and, you know, things like that. And I think,
but I think you'll run out of IDORs eventually,
well,
right?
I mean,
because everybody are
there's a lot of bug bounty programs out there, Sharon.
So if you're talking about this, so maybe you automate it somehow in a large scale, right? So you'll still innovate and improve yourself, because otherwise all the new bug bounty that are doing some kind of automations will eat you.
I think that's true, and we're always forced to grow as hackers, and that's one of the things that I like about my job here running this podcast, is that I have the opportunity to sit down and talk to you about techniques you use and research all of these techniques as they're coming out and delivering that to the public. But I think that if you say once or twice a day you're sitting down reading these write-ups and trying to replicate them as well, right? That's a big piece. You can read it.
Not all of them, of course, but I'm trying to use new tools, new methods, new ideas. Yeah. I'm trying to implement it, all of them, not all of them, right? But a big portion of them in my line of work.
Let this be a notice to all of the hackers that are out there listening to this, because even this guy is still doing all that. I think we could all use a little bit more of that. I've got a couple things here. I want to talk to you about the not so common attack surfaces that you like to go after. We covered sort of IoT devices and that sort of thing so far. But you've got some cool other things you like to go at in the bug bounty world.
So I have like these two hats, right? Mm-hmm. I'm doing bug bounties, and I also do binary exploitation and point to own. So if we're talking about specifically bug bounties, then I try to look at the not so common attack surface. Mm. So just like you said, usually most modern bug bounty hunters, I'd like to say for some reason are going directly to web, and bug bounty is not just web, but for some reason, for some reason, it's like the terminology is mixed, and bug bounty. When you say bug bounty, you usually refer to web. But I tried to look at other attack surfaces like DB to host escape. So sometimes applications will give you the ability to write into databases. And databases are complex beasts. So usually databases are very complex platforms, not usually not like web platforms, but they're not just for storing data. They contain a lot of different features. And if you have the ability to control somehow even your own database, in many cases you can leverage this into database to host escape and use some features, abuse some features of the database to escape from the database realm into the OS platform, and then from there to propagate and do maybe account takeovers, maybe get into other databases. It really depends on the platform, but I'm trying to do a bunch of those.
That is definitely an attack surface that not a lot of bug bounty hunters are going after. So I think this also decreases your dupability, right? Like, you know, there's a much lower chance you're going to get dupes when you're going after these really crazy attack surfaces.
Exactly.
And I see another one that you have here on the doc is sort of like external scanning or attacking services that aren't necessarily HTTP based.
And right, exactly.
That's a crazy one. And just anecdotally, I remember one live hacking event with another great hacker, Random Deduction. She went after these UDP based protocols that were all over the place on this attack surface. And you know, most of the time, let's say there's you know, most of the hackers that are just going after HTTP stuff, and then there's a wider, you know, percentage of hackers that are going after, okay, you know, I'll take a look at some, you know, TCP based services that are not HTTP, right? You know, because I'm going to be thorough here. And then there's an even smaller set that actually goes after anything UDP based. And she destroyed this target from some UDP based services. So I bet there is a lot of attack surface there that I and other, you know, primarily web based hackers look over a lot.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. So just like I said, almost all the bug bounty hunters are hunting web applications, but in many cases, you also find different protocols like TCP or UDP that are supported by the targets. And since I personally have a deep background into protocol
analysis,
that's
your bread and butter, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I tried to hunt for other protocols other than HTTP. Sometimes, for example, doing stuff with NTP and distributed denial of service, like if you can create these loops with NTP or to do stuff with SNMP, which are great protocols to manage devices, and they're implemented in almost any device that you can think of. The problem is whether they're exposed over the internet or not. And since they're UDP based, both NTP and SNMP, in many cases, again, not always, in many cases, they're overlooked in the firewall rules and firewall policies. And if you'll do these type of scans, or you'll use Shodan or Tsensys to do these type of scans for you, you'll find a bunch of targets that are actually listening for esoteric protocols and esoteric services that you can actually abuse and play with.
Wow, dude. That sounds like a lot of fun. A lot of fun in those games. I'm wondering, have you ever looked at like SIP protocol, or I'm trying to remember what those names of those protocols are that are like the routing protocols surrounding SIP. I can't pull them off the top of my head, but that's the majority of the experience that I've had with non-HTTP related protocol is SIP related stuff. And I'm wondering if you found anything there.
Yeah. So, SIP is actually very interesting. SIP is a signaling protocol. So SIP itself, SIP, because there is also CIP, which is a different protocol. But SIP, the signaling internet protocol, actually is the protocol that allows you to do the VoIP communication. So if I want to call to you over the internet, I'm most likely using a protocol suite that starts with SIP. And SIP is the signaling. So I want to call you. So I basically ring or tell the server, hey, I want to call Justin. And the server rings to you, and you get these UDP packets, SIP UDP packets, that tells you that Sharon wants to communicate with you. And then you do kind of a handshake and we communicate. And The interesting thing with the SIP is that after we establish communication, in many cases, we transfer the information to communicate directly.
Yeah, that's
So
the
we
interesting
move.
part, man. That's what I think would be really fun to play with.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually move from communicating over the cloud to direct communication, and the implementation for this, the reason, the logic is because we want to communicate directly without any interference. So we don't need the server anymore once we agree on ports to communicate. And once we agree on ports to communicate, we start to transfer media. And media is voice and video in most cases. So there are a bunch of different protocols. So you have SDP to actually communicate what type of ports and what type of media. So for example, I'm telling you, yeah, I'm going to transfer to you audio in this and that format, AAC and whatever. And you have another protocol for transfer the RTP to transfer the actual media itself. So it's a bunch of protocols that eventually allows us to communicate over VoIP. And there is a lot of attack surface over there. The problem is most of the modern applications, so for let's say WhatsApp or Telegram, they're using protocol stacks, modern protocol stacks that have been scrutinized and looked and reviewed a lot of time in different directions. So it's very difficult to find bugs in those areas. The potential for bugs in those areas is only if you'll take a look at the glue between the library itself, the protocol stack itself, and the application. Maybe you'll find a bug over there.
Wow, dude. Dude, I just want to tell the guests, this was not in the doc at all. Like we didn't mention anything about SIP beforehand. So that whole explanation about how SIP protocol works was just off the top of his head, which is
No,
just
it's because I researched a couple of C protocol stacks, and I actually found a bug or vulnerability. Actually, so I can call you and crash your application remotely over the server in one of the popular SIP stacks. So that's why I know about SIP specifically.
That's fun, man. When I found some bugs in the SIP stuff, a lot of it was having to do with the extra layer of authentication on top of SIP. And so there we got to a point where we were able to impersonate people and do like third-party registration, which is a part of the SIP protocol, which was really fun.
Cool.
All right. I'll let you go soon, Sean. I got this. I just want to talk really quickly about the documentation tracker and the reCAPTCHA bypass stuff that you put in the doc.
Yeah, so when I work on let's call it a long-term research, I try to be on top of things like new features, new updates, change logs, stuff like that. So for heavy targets, I'm writing in most cases, I'm writing a kind of a documentation tracker. So a documentation tracker is a fluff name to say that I'm I'm scraping the shit out of them. Documentation pages and release note pages and product pages and updates and the GitHub repositories. So I get all of this data and then I try to write what I call some modules. So for example, I have a module that summarizes everything into what new versions are available. What is the difference between different versions of an application? Sometimes, for a very specific and focused targets, I also do kind of automatic installation and binary diffing. And again, this is all part of the automation. But again, this essence of it is to understand and be on top of things like what are the new APIs, what are the new versions, features, etc.
Yeah, that's massive, man. I think a lot of people think about automation as like all right, let me do scanning, let me see new assets that are popping up, sort of an ASM sort of scenario. But in my experience, doing documentation tracking and or JS file diffing, if you're looking at a specific web application over time,
Functions, yeah.
man, you get so much cool stuff out of that. And you're the
Yeah, you
first
get
one to
all.
touch it too, because it just got pushed.
Exactly. And that's the key. That's the key. When you do bug bounty on scale, the key is to be first. And the way to do that is to to get a notification the second there is a new version. Yeah, exactly.
So how does this reCAPTCHA bypass thing work? Because I've done a lot of documentation tracking stuff, but I haven't ever integrated any reCAPTCHA bypass stuff to any of my workflows when creating accounts or anything.
Yeah, so I mean, in many cases when I do mostly brute force let's say account takeovers for different reasons. It doesn't have to be specifically for scraping, but scraping is a good use case for it. You'd want to have a lot of accounts. When I say a lot of accounts, I'm not talking about 10. I'm talking about like hundreds or thousands of accounts. And you can, in some cases, do it manually, like go one by one and click I'm not a robot. But essentially, you want to automate this because you want to make it work fast in scale. So there are some services online like tocaptcha.com that allow you to bypass some of the captchas, but they don't work in 100% of the cases. So sometimes they won't work. And I found this, you know, super stupid, simple method to bypass the reCAPTCHA by automating my using GUI, automating my mouse clicks.
Oh, no way.
Well, I mean, it's a bit smarter. It's not like the X, Y coordinates of the of the mouse. It's like hooking to components using specific classes or ID of the div or something
in the
like
DOM?
That.
Okay, gotcha.
In the DOM, exactly. And then you move the mouse over there and you do clicks. And you can automate it. There are a lot of different extensions to Chrome and Firefox to do that. For example, UI Vision is one of them. Yeah, I mean, you can just Google UI automation, Google Chrome extension, and you'll find a bunch of them. And surprisingly, they work, I wouldn't say flawlessly, but like in a great percentage of the time, they work great. And you can just use it to open thousands of accounts. Now, you need different email accounts, right? What I do is I just use Gmail with the plus. With a plus at the end, and in most websites, not most platforms, they will consider it as different accounts, and it will reach the same mailbox. So, so we just activate it by automation through your email account, and you use the automation to click and open all the accounts, and it just works.
Dude, that's awesome, man. It's pretty simple to set up. I mean,
yeah, it's very simple to set up, and it works great.
Wow. That's super cool, man. Yeah, I haven't had to use that, but I could see that being super helpful for scraping or for, you know, hitting API rate limits or something like that. Being able to have
API
multiple
rate
accounts.
Limits, scraping. If you want sometime to brute force, you know, OTPs for to do account takeover, that's great too.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Here's the last little section, and then I'll let you go. I'm sorry. I know I said that a couple times, but you have such interesting stuff.
I love
stuff,
it being
man.
Here.
solving. So I want to move away from the bug bounty stuff. You've given us enough tidbits for a lifetime. And I want to talk about why are you like, what is this scan my SMS thing? And, what makes you move from protocol engineer, binary exploitation, bug bounty? And then all of a sudden, you know what? I'm just going to solve phishing in Israel.
Yeah, yeah, you know, so
tell me about the project for the people.
The best way to do something is to be scammed, like motivation, right? So the thing that will move you the most is if one of your close friends or family got hit by a scammer.
Yeah.
Then you know you have all these YouTube channels that they try to pay back to the scammers. So in Israel, there is this. There are a lot of scams via SMS, smishing, what we call smishing, and because nobody wants to take the responsibility, and there is almost no money in it, because the end user will never pay for checking if something is phishing or not. Once my wife got scammed, I decided that I want to create like a center place for people to be able to to know if the SMS they received is legitimate or not. Because there are many services in Israel, organizations that are using SMS as a legitimate method to provide information. Mm. And they send you these shortener links with the text. And obviously, attackers and the bad guys are trying to imitate it, and they just copy-paste the text and replace it with another bit.ly kind of shortener URL, and you have the citizen, the end user, I call this end user, but it's actually a citizen, has no way to understand or to know if it's a legitimate or not. So I just built an automation that actually scans these URLs, actually keeps track on all the redirections, and do some kind of analysis on the end website, like what type of text, HTML, what kind of images. So, for example, if I'm identify images of financial institutions and the name of the website domain is not something that I know of, so probably it's a phishing. So I have this scoring mechanism.
Wow, that's pretty technically advanced there. Wow. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So I really wanted to provide a tool for citizens to be able to understand if the SMS they received is legitimate or not, and it actually caught. So in Israel, yeah. I wouldn't say everybody, but a lot of people are using this, and they're actually using this service, free service for the public, to understand if the SMS they received is legitimate or not.
Wow, dude, the Israeli government should buy this from you, and host it on like government website, and because it's a massive problem and it's something that affects the whole citizen base, like you said. And wow, dude, and so I guess this is using like AI to check it out, or is it actually hard code all of it that reaches out to the back end and like runs through an analysis based off of like the HTML and stuff like that?
Yeah, so we have a couple of different modules. Mm-hmm. I can talk about a few of them. So for example, we have AI that goes over the text to understand if it's a legitimate text or not. But again, since bad guys are copying and pasting the same text, in many cases it's difficult for the AI to catch on it. Because it's a legitimate text, just bad link, right? So most of the automation is focused on the scanning of the link itself, like unfurling, I think this is the right terminology, unfurling the link and keep track of all the redirections, and then check for each redirection, all the certificates, all the authenticity of the website. We're checking the third-party providers, like if blacklist kind of thing. And then for the final website, we're checking all the URLs in the final website. For example, scammers really like to send so they hate writing their own server backend. So they just use Telegram API to send the phishing data to the Telegram API. So in many cases, you'll find the phishing kits that they have no backend. It just whenever you fill all the details and click submit, right? Like here is my bank account, here's the password, yada yada yada, and click submit. It will all this information will be sent to a Telegram bot without any backend service. So we're looking at all these kind of indicators, as we call them, and we try to reach to a conclusion if it's phishing, if it's a scam, or if it's a legitimate website.
Wow, dude. Wow. Because I think it would have been so easy for you to say, oh, we've got this new shiny toy AI, you know, that can detect the misspellings or, you know,
but give us if we did that, we'll be part of the problem because the citizens do not know if the SMS they receive is legitimate or not because there are no tools to actually tell them, yeah, this is fully trusted or no, this is fully scam. And we wanted this binary result, true or false, scam or not scam. So we had to be a little bit more deterministic.
Wow, dude. Yeah, that's amazing. I it's very cool to see you not get distracted by the shiny thing that is AI and also, you know, use a hard tech solution as well in conjunction with the AI to give you, you know, a higher signal, Boolean, true or false, scam or not scam answer. Yeah.
And it all starts with a single event that triggers everything. Like my wife got scammed, and I was pissed. That's the rage
built up within you.
Yeah, just like when I was 16, I got the iPhone, and this was the event that changed the course of what interests me, and I wanted to learn more to write applications. So there is a single event that motivates you, and then you just follow this path.
Wow. Very cool, man. Very cool. All right. I will let you go. That was an amazing episode. Thanks for all of the details.
Thank you
so
much, Justin.
Yeah, it's been great having you on, man. All right. Peace. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.